controls the levers of power in America? Some are controlled by the House, some by the Senate, others by the President, who nominates Supreme Court justices. They can protect your free exercise of faith or take it away. Their rulings last for generations, impacting your kids and grandkids. Think about choosing your next president, because the ultimate lever of power is controlled by you. Your vote matters because the Supreme Court matters. Paid for by First Liberty Institute.
Welcome to another classic replay from the archives of Unbelievable. We hope you enjoy the conversation, and do let us know what you think. You can email us at unbelievable@premier.org.uk and leave comments on our Facebook page, Premier Unbelievable, or tweet us at UnbelievableFE. For many more resources to help both believers and sceptics to explore faith, please visit our website, premierunbelievable.com. Registering there will unlock access to all content on the website, as well as giving you special access through the weekly newsletter to exclusive content such as bonus videos and ebooks. That's premierunbelievable.com. And now, here's today's Unbelievable Classic Replay, hosted by Justin Brierley from 2016.
And today we're remembering one of the world's favourite anti-theists, I think, and we're asking, was Christopher Hitchens right about religion? It was over 4 years ago now that Christopher Hitchens lost a battle with cancer, but during his life he was one of the leading lights of the so-called New Atheist movement and probably one of its most eloquent writers and speakers. His book, God Is Not Great, How Religion Poisons Everything, became a bestseller around the world, around the same time as books such as The God Delusion and Letter to a Christian Nation by fellow co-atheists were also becoming popular. Well, today we're going to be discussing his legacy with three guests. Peter Harris is a Christian currently researching a PhD on Christopher Hitchens' criticisms of religion. Ed Turner is a lawyer and atheist blogger whose own anti-theism was heavily influenced by Christopher Hitchens. And finally, Peter Hitchens, the brother of Christopher, joins us by phone. Peter, as a Christian believer, of course, had a very different perspective to his brother, and he'll be talking about that in the course of today's programme. Very warm welcome to you all, gentlemen. Thank you for joining me on today's programme. Before we come to Peter and Ed, Peter Harris, we're going to have two Peters, and it's going to be confusing. Yes. But Peter, you were the one who suggested perhaps doing this topic, because you're actually, unusually, doing a PhD in this area.
Yes.
What prompted you to do that?
Well, I was going through a period of doubt in my life about my Christian faith, probably about 8 years ago, and I'd read Richard Dawkins' The God Delusion, and came across Christopher Hitchens as well, and initially was bowled over by this man's public persona, and began to read his books as well, and decided that he would make a very good object of study. However, what I would say is that the longer I've read his stuff, the more the errors and the weaknesses in his arguments become more apparent. But in a sense, doing a PhD, you don't simply take an adversarial position with your object of study. I'm also an expositor as well. So one of the chapters that I've put into my PhD is really to explain what exactly was his anti-theism. So obviously defining it first before then actually ranging a series of arguments against it. Hopefully arguments that other people have not yet used, because that's the whole aim of a PhD. So I'm fascinated by Christopher Hitchens as a thinker, as a writer. Not as impressed as I am fascinated.
Okay, well, we'll come to some of the areas that you're tackling in that work shortly. Ed, you have never written a PhD on Christopher Hitchens, but you certainly have had a long-time interest in him. He probably is and was your favourite of the atheist writers.
Rest is a mortal song.
What particularly attracted you to Hitch?
Well, I read The God Delusion first by Dawkins in 2007 when I was away travelling. I came across Hitchens' book. I think I saw it in a bookshop, and obviously the title was very, very provocative, but I didn't actually buy it. And I first of all saw a few of his debates that were posted on the Dawkins website, and particularly his debate against Alistair McGrath. I was just absolutely bowled over by his directness, his acid wit, his Dawkins is accused of being shrill and strident. I mean, Hitchens just gives both barrels and then reloads and gives both barrels again and again and again and again. And he was just so eloquent. So I read God Is Not Great, and then I read, you know, his articles. I mean, he wrote, I think, more than most people have read in their lives.
He was prolific.
He was very prolific, yeah, yeah. So, you know, I read his collections of essays of Love, Poverty and War, and, you know, obviously, you know, his works against politicians, people like Henry Kissinger and the Clintons as well. I mean, he just, he was just such a sniper of a writer.
I mean, I don't know, lots of people have talked about him being a rhetorician,
yes.
And God Is Not Great was more a, what's the word, if it's rather than an argument, it's more of a...
polemic.
A polemic, that's the word I'm searching for. Would you agree with that yourself, Peter?
Yeah, well, God Is Not Great is a book that I think tries to satisfy two types of audience. One is the popular audience, which of course he would appeal to as a journalist. But also it does try to be academic as well. So it tries to suit both audiences. I don't think it's fully successful in being an academic text, partly because of the lack of footnoting at the end, which I think he was criticised before for. But it certainly is a very important contribution to the New Atheists. And I would agree with Ed that I find Christopher Hitchens probably the most easy to listen to and read among the New Atheists.
Indeed. It was always an experience to listen to him.
Absolutely.
As well as to read him. And we will hear from him in the course of today's programme. I've got a bit of audio lined up just to give a sense of a reminder of the brilliant speaker that he was. Also joining us on the line is Peter Hitchens. Peter, thank you very much for joining us today. Not an easy thing, in a sense, to do a retrospective on someone who is obviously a family member. Tell us, though, how did you end up taking such very different paths, in a nutshell, in terms of your separate beliefs?
Two different people.
Mm.
Why shouldn't we? Mm. Why would you expect, and from what everything we know about families and brothers, why would you expect two brothers to take the same path? What would be surprising about...
I suppose one might expect if two brothers with similar upbringing, similar backgrounds, there might be some way in which you might expect a similar outlook to develop, but obviously, say everyone.
Why? I mean, if people's outlooks develop, I mean, we could to people who weren't very used to our voices, we could impersonate each other on the telephone because people would. One was the other.
Did you carry out such pranks?
There are other mannerisms which we probably have in common, which you could attribute to upbringing and having the same parents. But otherwise, individuals develop. Mm. My experience of life is different from his. I'm a different sort of person from him. I'm constitutionally Puritan, and he—I think I could say without fear of contradiction—wasn't. And I know we had. We don't actually. There are family similarities. We don't look the same. We were born 2.5 years apart. My own view is that I've had different, in my view, more education and experiences in life than he did, and therefore I understand something's better than he did. But I would say that, wouldn't I? But we're different. From the moment you start growing up, you have immense amounts of different experiences, even if you're twins, which we certainly were not.
Yes. I mean, you did have a period of atheism yourself.
Definitely, yes.
So in that sense...
I think most Western people in this age did or do. It's not. I don't count that as. I learned to swim as well, and all kinds of things. And I did stupid things in my teenage years, but these are things which people do. They're not starting. What I find interesting is that the old process where people used to have childish adolescent views in their adolescence and then adult views in adulthood has stopped, and people continue having childish adolescent views up until the day they die. I'm tired of being asked why I have done what everybody throughout every generation in history until this one has done and grown up.
Right.
The interesting thing is why so many people have not grown up in later life.
It's an interesting perspective. Why then, if you could hazard a guess, did your brother develop such an animosity towards religion? He didn't just call himself an atheist, he called himself an anti-theist.
Well, because he enjoyed it, which was a huge impulse on his part. He liked to have fun. He loved he loved debate. He enjoyed disagreeing with people, and when they disagreed with him, he enjoyed telling them they were wrong. I have that characteristic.
Yes, I was saying there are some shared characteristics.
Yeah, no, I don't dispute that. It is fun. Arguing is one of the great pleasures. I think that it's a straightforward point that comes in your life, and I've said it over and over again, that there is a reason why people choose to believe that there is no God. Unusually, among atheists, the American philosopher Thomas Nagel concedes this blatantly obvious point, but almost every other atheist I've ever discussed it was, oh, no, there's no motive in this, I just can't believe in it, it's not possible, as if belief was some kind of mystical thing over which the human mind had no control. It's perfectly obvious all of us in our lives believe what we want to believe, especially about things where there is no knowledge which can decide for us what we have to believe. We therefore have a choice. So why would you want to choose a totally chaotic, random universe, a gigantic cosmic car crash, in which nothing had any significance beyond its immediate effects, and your worldly life had no consequences after you were dead? Why would anybody choose that? Well, the answer is so blazingly obvious, it's barely worth asking the question. It's the reason why people are atheists. They don't want those consequences. They don't want their actions to have any significance. They don't particularly want justice for themselves in the universe, so they can't seek it for others. It's been the case since people started saying, as if it were tremendously brave, there is no God, about 10,000 years ago. It's nothing new. I'm amazed at the way in which it's treated as some kind of fascinating intellectual novelty, when it's absolutely nothing of the kind. The Bible is full of people being described as being godless, or indeed roaming after pagan deities, which are very much the same as the things which atheists were.
Well,
what's so new about this? What's so exciting? What's so refreshing? I can't see it.
Well, perhaps so. He was someone who had many interests, but I guess...
Well, yeah, I mean, this thing which always absolutely astonishes me in this conversation is that the people who love him for being against God and in favor of sex, drugs, and rock and roll, which is, of course, the fundamental reason why people are against God, because they think God is against sex, drugs, and rock and roll. All these people who revere him for that are also people who absolutely loathe the position that he took on the war in Iraq. But they give him a free pass on the war in Iraq, where he advocated policies which led to the bombing of civilians in their homes and the destruction of an entire country, and actually resulted in the end of peace in the Middle East and the awful, hellish arrangements we have there now. But they don't care about that. They put his atheism way among us. I'm a terrible and terrific admirer of your brother, said it, because of his. And I said, well, what about the right? Well, I say, well, yes, that was wrong, but it doesn't really seem to register.
Yeah.
The real thing that matters is his advocacy of unfettered hedonism, which is what atheism.
Well,
is.
We will get
really,
to.
They don't care about. Although they claim to care about all those.
Right. We'll see what Ed has.
They don't actually care about it at all. What they care about is what everybody always cares about all the time, fundamentally, is themselves. And atheism is the worship of the self. And that's and he was very good at it, and in a sort of dismissive way. And you would expect, wouldn't you, an advocate of self-worship to be dismissive and arrogant towards those who disagree with it, because that would kind of fit.
Well, we will see what Ed has to say in response to that, and Peter as well. Thank you for joining us on the programme today, Peter. Really appreciate your input on this from a personal level. We're remembering the world's favourite anti-theist. I think he probably was anyway. Christopher Hitchens. Was he right about religion? Of course, it was over 4 years now since he passed away. But his book, God Is Not Great, really set the scene for much of the new atheism. And we're going to be hearing, in his own words, some of what he had to say about that in a short moment's time. This is Unbelievable, the show that aims to get you thinking every Saturday afternoon with me, Justin Brierley.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Well, today on the programme, we're remembering the world's favourite anti-theist. Was Christopher Hitchens right about religion? My guests, Peter Harris, Ed Turner and Peter Hitchens, the brother of Christopher, joining me for today's show. So why don't we hear Christopher Hitchens himself on one of the reasons he believed religion poisons everything.
The wish to be slaves. The wish to be told what to do. Now, just as we all like to think, and we live under written documents and proclamations that encourage us to think that it is our birthright and our most precious need to be free, to be liberated, to be untrammeled. So we also know that, unfortunately, the innate in people is the servile, is the wish to be told what to do, is the adoration for strong and brutal and cruel leaders, that this other baser element of the human makeup has to be accounted for and gives us a great deal of trouble around the world as we speak. Religion, in my view, is a reification, a distillation of this wish to be a serf, to be a slave. Ask yourself if you really wish it was true that there was a celestial dictatorship that watched over you from the moment you were born, actually the moment you were conceived, all through life, night and day, knew your thoughts, waking and sleeping. Could in fact convict you of thought crime. The absolute definition of a dictatorship can convict you for what you think and what you privately want, what you're talking about to yourself, that monitors you like this under permanent surveillance, control, and supervision, and doesn't even let go of you when you're dead, because that's when the real fun begins. Now, my question is this. Who wishes that that were true? Who wants to lead the life of a serf in a celestial North Korea? I've been to North Korea. I'm one of the very few writers who has. I'm indeed the only writer who's been to all three axis of evil countries, Iran, Iraq, and North Korea. And I can tell you, North Korea is the most religious state I've ever been to. I used to wonder when I was a kid, what would it be like praising God and thanking him all day and all night? Well, now I know. Because North Korea is a completely worshipful state. It's set up only to do that, for adoration. And it's only one short of a trinity.
There you go. A little bit of Christopher Hitchens speaking and likening God to a celestial North Korean dictator. Perhaps I'll come back to you, Peter, and then Ed, for some reflections on this. What did you make of these kinds of themes that Hitchens developed in his anti-theistic work?
Well, the statement that we've just heard from Christopher Hitchens is a very famous series of ideas. We hear these ideas very often from him. And I would say that actually it's his anti-totalitarianism, his libertarianism. When I say libertarianism, I don't mean to say that anything goes. I mean, I think Christopher Hitchens had a very strong moral code. But his hatred for all things absolute, political absolutes in particular, leads him to his anti-theism, because, of course, he conceives God as being a totalitarian. And I think this is a flaw. I mean, if you look at the Christian God is a trinity. So at the heart of the concept of the Christian God is relationship. We also talk about God as the God of love, and also God as the guarantee of free choice, because in a material universe, it's very hard to see where one might get the possibility of free will. And one thing that has always struck me is that if God is such a totalitarian, why is there so much disobedience and rebellion, even among his own children? Mm. Surely, if you know, the nature of the totalitarian state is actually to deal with rebellion at its source. And yet we see people ignoring what God wants them to do, and so on and so on. But one thing I do advance in my dissertation is the idea that God himself is a victim of totalitarianism. Now, I don't expect Ed to accept this proposition, but if we say that Christ is the Son of God, and we look at his life in the Gospels, we see him actually the victim of three absolutisms: the Herodian absolutism, the attempt on his life as a child by Herod the Great, the absolutism of Jewish theocracy, which sets him up for his death, and of course the absolutism of Roman law. So Christ actually suffers totalitarian or absolute persecution. I would want to suggest an alternative totalitarian within this universe, and that's the law of sin. People feeling almost compelled to do wrong things, unable to resist doing wrong things. I think that's the totalitarian.
And was Hitchens at some level guilty of a sort of naive optimism that if we ditch God, we'll all be happier and in a secular society?
No, I don't think he ever thought that. John Lennox, in his book Gunning for God, Why the Atheists Are Wrong, actually refers to a conversation he had with Christopher Hitchens, in which Christopher Hitchens said that humanity is, you know, by its own lights, very evil indeed.
Mm. He didn't share that the optimism you find in some of the writers who seem to think that if you ditch religion, we'll all be much happier.
I think he believed that we would be happier, but I don't think he ever believed that religion would go away.
No.
That's one of the main differences between him and the other new atheists. His argument is actually an evolutionary one. It's not a cultural one. He says that religion is actually innate to us, and it won't go away for the foreseeable future. So what do you do with it? Well, he argued that you actually tame it within a secular society. So religion becomes a practice within the province of people's personal lives, and you hedge around it laws. And so in a sense, you tame this yes. potential beast.
You neuter the thing. Interesting perspectives there. Ed, has Hitchens' famous idea, this theme of God as a celestial dictator, been one that's been a powerful one for you?
I think it's a fascinating argument. It's one of the few arguments where I sort of almost disagreed with him. I think maybe he put too much thought in it, into it, because it actually plays to Peter Hitchens's argument that people want to be atheists and people want to believe, you know, what they want to believe.
They don't want to be under such a supreme authority.
Exactly. Now, I suppose if you you lie all day in a bath and you think about these things, then yes, I'm glad that Hitler didn't win the Second World War. I'm glad that Stalinism did not expand, you know, beyond the Berlin Wall. I'm glad that I don't live in North Korea, you know, there, but for the grace of God goes some other poor unfortunate person. Yes. I think it's... I wouldn't mind either way. I would accept it if there was actually some evidence for it. I would actually accept it. And
you don't personally have a problem then, in principle, with the idea of a divine judge, a divine sort of person who inevitably you are answerable to.
Well, I think it's a bit of a sinister idea, yes, but there's I'm not saying it's attractive to me. I can understand. I do sympathise with the religious mentality in its desire to believe that our thoughts and actions do have some kind of cosmic significance, and that life ultimately has some kind of purpose and meaning, and as a way of getting through, you know, what is a very cruel and unforgiving world at times. I can understand that. I can't bring myself to believe it because there's just absolutely no evidence for it at all, and people... The only evidence that I've heard, the only arguments that I've heard, just amount to wishful thinking. And
I mean, that was what Christopher Hitchens often said: "There's not a shred of evidence. There's not, and if you just give me some of that, and so on." And perhaps we'll come to that as well, because I think that there are those who have said actually, in the end, he was given a good amount of evidence, and maybe he should have changed his rhetoric on that at least. Peter, I'm sure you came across this a number of times: the divine dictator argument. What's your response to it?
Which Pete, are you asking me?
Yes, you, Peter Hitchens.
You've got two Peters, you have to say.
I will. I'll distinguish my Peters.
Oh, I think it's the most complete twaddle. One only needs to consider the voluntary nature of belief and the great first collect at morning prayer in the 1662 prayer book: "O God, who art the author of peace and lover of concord, in knowledge of whom standeth our eternal life, whose service is perfect freedom." Materialists always used to insist, when there still were Marxist materialists among us, that freedom was the knowledge of necessity. In the Christian view, freedom is the knowledge and understanding of the laws given to us by God, by which we should live well and aim to return his love. And that's that is not a dictatorship. And it's just, of course, absurd to condemn as a dictator a God who in his time on earth submitted to the most grotesque dictatorial show trial and experienced at first hand the torture and prejudice and presumption of guilt which such regimes impose upon those who stand up against them. I can't think of anything more ridiculous to say, but it appeals to the kind of adolescent audiences to which he spoke and who bought his book, because these people, particularly in the United States, had spent all their lives being brought up in Christian homes with Christian pastors and being told the Christian message was true, and they'd arrived at a point in their lives where this contradicted with their desire to have promiscuous sex and take drugs. And they really, really relished having an articulate, Oxford-educated smoothie humorously defending this position. But celestial dictator, what a lot of rubbish. I also have been to North Korea and Iran, and indeed the post-Hitchens Iraq with the big holes in it and the destroyed society and the lack of electricity. And it just doesn't actually carry very much weight in a serious argument. As for this claim that there is no evidence of the existence of God, of course there's evidence. The evidence, of course, is governed in any court by its admissibility. The thing about atheists is they refuse to admit the evidence which theists would actually advance, as in the earth is crowned with heaven, and every common bush afire with God, but only he who sees takes off his shoes. The rest sit round it and eat blackberries. If you are inclined to consider the possibility, and for goodness sake, Einstein considered the possibility of a theistic explanation, if you're inclined to consider the possibility, there's masses of evidence there. What there isn't is definitive proof. You're left on your own to decide. No dictator gives you the freedom to decide whether to obey him or not.
Mm. That's an interesting point. Peter, just quickly, one of the things, Peter Harris in this case, okay. One of the things that Peter Hitchens was saying there was that, in his view, both his brother and the atheists who followed him were looking for this kind of hedonism that gave them license to. Now, but you said you believe Christopher did have a strong moral code, which doesn't seem to fit quite with the description Peter Hitchens here is giving.
Yeah, I don't think I'm the only person to say that. I think Alistair McGrath has detected that. He talks about the moral backbone of Christopher Hitchens. I think John Lennox as well. Various other opponents of him detected that.
Moral in what sense? As in railing against immoral institutions and so on? I mean, he obviously wrote very critically of various types of government and church institutions.
Well, I never had the chance to meet Christopher Hitchens. I've had a chance, obviously not. I think one of the things that his opponents picked up in him was a real distaste for hypocrisy. And I think that that's one of the most serious lines of argument that he has against the church.
I'd be interested, Peter Hitchens, do you agree with Peter Harris on this point?
We're all against hypocrisy except when we do it. And that's public declarations of your goodness in terms of, gosh, I'm in favour of justice. And the old Tom Lehrer, now I'm against poverty, war and injustice, unlike the rest of you squares, are nowadays quite rightly dismissed as virtue signalling. It doesn't mean anything
okay.
about the person to say that you're against bad things. So what? I'm against bad things too. But it doesn't
right.
give you any idea at all of what kind of person I am.
Okay, let's, Ed, do want to include you as well before we go to a quick break. I mean, do you think that Christopher Hitchens had this sort of, what was he aiming at hedonism in the end? This is the view that Peter Hitchens has put forward. That's why most atheists actually ultimately reject God. They don't want to be ruled over.
Well, I don't know whether hedonism is the right word or, you know, puritanism is the right word. I mean, certainly Christopher obviously liked his booze and fags and, you know, his sex and drugs and rock and roll. But he was an exquisitely moral man. He was, he was a feminist. He was an advocate of civil rights. He was an anti-racist. He didn't just launch broadsides against religion. He launched broadsides against, plenty of other people, including one of the Democratic presidential incumbents and her husband. I think this sort of boils down to, you know, the arguments of, you know, the secularist atheist position of sexuality. You know, whatever people get up to in their own homes, in the privacy of their own homes, as long, you know, between two consenting adults, you know, that really shouldn't bother anyone else, and it certainly shouldn't bother the all divine, all knowing creator of the universe, if indeed she exists. I think that's what he was in favour of freedom, and he was in favour of sexual expression, and he criticised what he called the dangerous sexual repression of the Catholic Church, which was celibacy, and then giving rise to what was essentially a global paedophile ring.
Well, we'll come back to you, and we'll come back to Peter Hitchens and indeed Peter Harris. So we're talking about Christopher Hitchens today on Unbelievable, remembering the world's favourite anti-theist and whether he was right about religion. We're really interesting discussion today as we look at some of the ideas he propounded and reflections from my guests, Peter Harris, Ed Turner and Peter Hitchens.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Welcome back to the second part of today's programme. Unbelievable brings you conversations between Christians and non-Christians. We'll be back into our discussion about Christopher Hitchens and his anti-theism in a moment's time. Later on, we'll be hearing some of your feedback as well. And if you'd like to get in touch, then a good way to do that is via email. That's unbelievable@premier.org.uk. Other ways to get in touch via Facebook, Twitter and so on are on the website, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. And of course, links there to the newly announced Unbelievable the Conference 2016. Discover Your Inner Evangelist is our theme, but there'll be lots of other topics and seminars going on throughout the day. For instance, how to show the resurrection is real. Help, the internet just told me Jesus didn't exist. What about other faiths? Former atheist confessions. What Do I Do With My Doubts, and Reaching Young People Who Have Walked Away. So there's lots to look forward to if you're coming along to this year's Unbelievable, the conference 2016. Go to premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable2016 to get the full details. So continuing our conversation today on Christopher Hitchens, over 4 years ago he lost his battle with cancer, but he was, especially towards the end of his life, one of the leading lights of the so-called New Atheist Movement, one of its most eloquent writers and speakers. And his book, God Is Not Great, How Religion Poisons Everything, became a bestseller around the world, around the same time as other books by Dawkins and Harris and so on. The God Delusion, Letter to a Christian Nation were also becoming popular. And we're talking about his legacy today. Peter Harris, a Christian currently researching a PhD on Hitchens' criticisms of religion, is with me. Ed Turner is in studio as well. He's a lawyer and atheist blogger who was very much influenced by the anti-theism of Christopher Hitchens. And Peter Hitchens, brother of Christopher, joins us by phone as well. He, of course, sharing a very different perspective on faith to his late brother. I wanted to talk about one of the things that Hitchens wrote down in God Is Not Great, and he kind of summarised three conclusions about religions by saying this. The first is that religion and the churches are manufactured. The second is that ethics and faith are quite independent of faith and cannot be derived from it. And the third is that religion is, because it claims a special divine exemption for its practices and beliefs, not just amoral, but immoral. And these, in a sense, could be summed up as three significant key arguments in the new atheism in many ways. Religion is manufactured, ethics and faith are independent of faith, and religion is immoral because of the way it claims divine exceptions for its practices. What do you say to the first one, Peter Harris, that religion is manufactured? That was sort of something he sort of assumed, really, from the outset, that these the churches and religion have been made up, essentially.
Well, there are a number of things that I could say in response to that. I think it's based very much upon the views presented by people like Feuerbach and Freud that religion is actually some sort of psychological wish thinking. So, for example, in the case of Freud, the idea is that God is some sort of super daddy in the sky, which of course is a great fantasy maybe of lots of human beings, the idea that everything will turn out in the end okay if this God actually does exist. I think I'd have to put the question back to people who say this and ask, well, obviously atheists would see atheism as a human construct because, of course, there is no God to construct their atheism for them, if there is such a God. But the other question is, to what extent is atheism a psychological compensation as well?
So it cuts both ways.
It does cut
is what
both
you're
ways,
saying.
Certainly. The chapter where Christopher Hitchens discusses this is a chapter where he picks three religions as evidence of human construction. And at the risk of patronising everyone, I'll list them. The cargo cult of the Polynesians, what he calls the evangelical hucksterism that the film Marjo exposes, people asking for money in return for healing, and Mormonism. Now, this whole area of the origins of religion is actually a highly specialised area. There's a vast literature on it. I mean, my argument would be, I don't think you can look at those religions and necessarily say that they are human constructs. You actually have to have come to the conclusion that there is no God, first of all, in order to be able to say that they are human constructs, because for all we know, there may be a God in this universe who does inspire Mormonism, cargo cults, and evangelical hucksterism. I don't think there is, but that is indeed a logical argument. And of course, I would want him in the chapter to actually explain how he could extrapolate to all religions from just the three that he chooses, why he chooses those three religions. I think it's again a chapter that exposes, where he actually exposes, without in meaning to, the limitations to his own scholarship.
And I suppose it could be argued not all religions have the same claim to veracity as each other. So comparing a cargo cult with the historical claims of Christianity,
yes,
you're not comparing the same sort of thing.
No, but I mean, even if you do take a pluralist view, you run into problems because of his lack of scholarship. I think it's a reflection of how this text tries to be quite a few things.
Do you think, Ed, that Christopher Hitchens dealt adequately with the claims of religions like Christianity when he said ultimately it all boils down to wishful thinking and sort of, these Freudian impulses we have to have a Sky Daddy and so on.
Well, yes, Peter Harris has just sort of waved off that very important chapter in God Is Not Great on how religions begin by, you know, rather disappointingly waving the old canard, saying lack of scholarship. You know, there's no comparison between the Mormons and, you know, and Joseph Smith and, you know, the historical claims of Jesus. Well, it just seems to me that we simply don't have enough evidence because of the passage of time. You know, we don't have television documentaries in the case of cargo cults and historical records and, you know, people within living memory to show what exactly happened. Now, Richard Dawkins discusses cargo cults in The God Delusion, and he very cleverly references Monty Python's Life of Brian, where, you know, Brian falls out of a window, assumes, you know, for 2 seconds, assumes the role of a preacher, you know, and John Cleese and everyone else, because he's abandoned his sandal, are suddenly, you know, the whole of Jerusalem follows him, proclaiming to be the Messiah. Now, you know, I don't think, you know, that is a million miles away from what's actually happened. I mean, if people, you know, can believe that, you know, Allied forces bringing supplies and creating runways on an island are, you know, is the result of, you know, divine intervention. And it didn't just happen on one island. It happened on many islands. Mm. I mean, it's the New Hebrides, the island of Tanna, is the one that's usually cited. But it actually happened independently. That there's obviously something, you know, that this was obviously a religious
instinct. So you think there's a sort of a religious gullibility.
Yeah, exactly.
Sort of
and people who, you know, people like Marjo Gortner, who, you know, and I've seen his documentary where he came back. He was a child preacher. And I've seen the documentary where he came back a few years later and he just admitted on camera, look, these are all my tricks. This is how I work the crowd. You know, he had a walk on stage that he based on Mick Jagger. you know, and people still, you know, and people will still believe it.
Yes.
So I can't remember his name now. There was a guy that James Randi exposed on, you know, The Tonight Show or Saturday Night Live.
Saw some of these people claiming healing and so on who have been exposed.
He was bankrupted for about 10 years, but then he came back and he was doing
exactly the
same
thing. I think you're thinking of Peter Popper, I think is the Popoff. Peter Hitchens, while we've still got you, what's your take on your late brother's view of religion essentially being wishful thinking in that sense?
Well, so is a lot of secular utopianism wishful thinking. One needs only study the huge swooning multitudes of intellectuals and artistic persons who were completely taken in by the Soviet Union during the years when, in fact, a huge amount of evidence of its murderous dictatorial nature was already available. And who believed, you only need to read the Beatrice and Sidney Webb's ridiculous book, which is still luckily available, about the new civilization of the Soviet Empire, the final proofs of which were being signed off as Stalin made his pact with Hitler, to see just how gullible secularists can be. It's the same argument as you can make over the complaints against the Catholic Church of child sex abuse. Indeed, the Catholic Church has had problems with child sex abuse and has not handled them very well, but very large numbers of secular organizations, including children's homes and the BBC, have also had problems with sex abuse and haven't handled them very well either. The church doesn't mandate sex abuse any more than the BBC or children's homes, but it happens, and it's a problem of human wrongdoing. People who want to argue about the badness or goodness of religion really need to do better than these pathetic cliches. So gullibility is by no means confined to religious believers and can be found in highly intellectual secularists all the time. In my lifetime, the Soviet apologists tended to fade away, but there were plenty in the 1960s of apologists for Mao Zedong, probably the biggest mass murderer ever to stalk the earth. And subsequently, there have been, of course, various regimes in Central America which have attracted the same thing. And to this day, the ghastly regime in Cuba has many, many sympathizers among very intelligent, well-read secularists in the West who completely blind themselves to the way that it murders people, tortures people, and indeed has been for many years extremely unpleasant to homosexuals. It's extraordinary what people can persuade themselves to believe if they want to, and it's nothing to do with religion. It's to do with human gullibility. Yes. Man is not great would seem to me to be the starting point that we need to work from.
Yes, rather than God being not great, it's our own, it's within us. What's your response?
These things are not arguments against religion.
Yes.
Religions are full of faulty and bad and inadequate people, and because they are people, and because people are faulty, bad, and inadequate, doesn't mean that the idea of religious truth is itself discredited by this.
Yes. Ed, you wanted to respond to that.
Yeah, your point about a lot of Western academic intellectuals being sucked in by Stalinism, and yeah, I absolutely agree with you. I mean, you know, Bertrand Russell was one of them. I think H.L. Mencken even wrote a, you know, fawning review of Mein Kampf. But a lot of these people actually, once they were presented with the evidence, they actually admitted that they were wrong. I mean, your late brother himself admitted that he had to abandon Marxism because it was just not a philosophy that worked.
That's not actually accurate. First of all, Bertrand Russell should be excused from this. He was one of the earliest to see through Lenin and to realize what a menace Lenin was. Mm-hmm. Numbers of others were not so quick. But my brother remained to the end of his life an admirer of Leon Trotsky, who, had he beaten Stalin for the leadership of the Soviet Union, would have proved, if not as great a mass murderer as Stalin, certainly a comparable one, because of his morals, which were those of utopianism, and he believed that any sacrifice of life was justified for the end in which he believed, and he behaved in this way when he had the power to do so. So I think it's idle to say that my brother turned his back on this. The other thing is that, sure, you say when evidence emerged, but actually evidence was available. The first reports of the gulags and of the Solovyetsky prison camps and of the murders of priests and others and the terrible horrors of the Civil War had emerged from the Soviet Union in the early 1920s. And these fellow travelers who swooned at it and said that it was a new civilization continued to say so for many, many years after it was well known that it was not so. And I don't accept that defense at all. They blinded themselves to known facts over and over and over again. And Robert Conquest's book, The Great Terror, which is now praised by everybody, oh, what a great book it is, at the time it was published and for many years afterwards, was dismissed in respectable academic circles by people who continue to make apologies for the Soviet Union and to admire academics such as Eric Hobsbawm, who continue to defend the Soviet experiment. No, I don't buy that, I'm afraid.
Ethics and faith are quite independent of faith was the second claim that I mentioned from Christopher Hitchens. He was well known for this phrase, and perhaps you'd like to comment on it, Peter Harris. I challenge you to find one good or noble thing which cannot be accomplished without religion. The point being, religion simply has no purchase on our ability to do good deeds. In fact, you can't find a good deed that couldn't be equally carried out by someone without any kind of religious faith. What's your take on this, Peter Harris?
Well, my response has often been that Christians are not saying, or religion, well, I don't know about other religions, I'm not here to apologise for them, but other Christians have never said that you can't be moral if you don't have a belief in God. Obviously, you know, the evidence of our own eyes, our own interactions with atheists and secularists and so on. And there's biblical warrant for this, the very famous Romans 2:14-15 that talks about people keeping the law of God without actually knowing the law of God because of the dictates of their conscience. So the epistemic problem is not there. People know what is right and wrong, I think, generally. I think the bigger problem is when you try to provide an objective foundation for your ethics as an atheist or a materialist, naturalist, or so on. And Christopher Hitchens often sort of spoke in tones of voice that suggest that he believed objectively in morality, that there are moral facts in this universe.
Did he ever address this, what is often a key argument for theism, the idea that there is a moral lawgiver, that's the only way to justify the idea of objective moral beliefs, values, duties and so on. Did he ever address that argument specifically?
Yes. I mean, he actually uses an essay by a philosopher called Elizabeth Anderson in his book The Portable Atheist, which talks about how through an evolutionary process, certain traits have arisen in humanity, which we also therefore call good. And so he provides an evolutionary origin for morality, but there are many problems with that. Stephen Jay Gould, for instance, has said that if you rerun evolution, you might actually end up with a very different type of being. So, for example, if we had, I don't know, evolved to be a lot more physically impressive than we are. We might not be as sociable as we are because our sociability as a species is our defence against predators. Take us on our own, we're pretty pathetic physically, put us into large groups and we're very formidable, particularly our capacity to make weapons. So if we, let's say, had become more like tigers, we had a tigerish morality, altruism and sharing and sociability would have been a lot less important in our ethics. So what you therefore have on the basis of evolution are contingent ethics.
Yes, not these objective type of ones.
Absolutely.
Ed, any commentary on this? Do you think Christopher Hitchens did believe in some sort of objective morality, or was he in the end really just about the advantages that certain evolutionary traits have brought to us?
I think this was one of his arguments that wasn't really made out as well as it could have been philosophically. He has a chapter in his book, Does Religion Make People Behave Better? And he discusses everyone from Martin Luther King to Gandhi to Evelyn Waugh. And he takes it from... It's more of an observable trait. So for Evelyn Waugh said, you know, just think how bad I would be if I wasn't a Catholic. And Hitch comes back with, well, think of the awful things that Waugh said, you know, when he because as a direct result of being a Catholic, you know, praising Mussolini's invasion of Ethiopia and telling a divorcee friend on the eve of her second marriage that she was only increasing the agony of on the cross. And I don't think he ever really discussed as to whether, you know, sort of from the William Lane Craig perspective, as to whether... morals exist outside of human behaviour. So, but I think he certainly
he obviously didn't believe.
I think he probably did believe in objective morality. He just didn't make the argument out as well as he could have done.
I mean, this famous phrase of his of "I challenge you to find one good or noble thing which cannot be accomplished without religion."
Yeah.
Do you agree?
I mean, I agree with his. I mean, no one ever beat his challenge. It really answered his. His challenge very well. They came up with sort of rather silly examples, like a Jewish soldier jumping on a hand grenade and praising God, in order to save his comrades. But yes. A Muslim could have done that, saying sure. Allahu Akbar. And,
let's bring in Peter Hitchens.
He answered this conundrum in my presence.
Go ahead.
At a discussion in Washington D.C. after he'd fallen. He said that he had, after serious thought, come up with at least one action, good action, which could only have been done by a religious person. And this was Lech Wałęsa's leading of the solidarity strike against the communist regime in Poland. He didn't think that anybody who didn't fear God, as Wałęsa did, could conceivably have stood up against the forces, which he did. So he did, in fact, in the end, answer his own question, though no one else.
That's very interesting.
And I was there when he did it. On the question of absolute morality, he didn't, as so many atheists don't, he didn't understand the question because he simply couldn't fathom the point that that when he said that such and such a thing was moral, he was calling on a religious definition of morality, an absolute religious definition of morality, while refusing to acknowledge its origin. And I find this over and over again with atheists. They simply don't get it, and it goes past them. And I remember him saying, when it was put to him, that went straight past my bat. He simply couldn't grasp it. The free rider aspect of atheism, where atheists say that, often atheists are very, very confident and indeed self-praising about their own level of morality. But the morality to which they are referring is religiously based Christian morality, which the origin of which cannot be disputed. But they judge themselves on the basis of this while saying they have no interest or no belief in the force which actually gives rise to it. The whole problem of the rule of law and why any force should be above naked power in society can only really be resolved if you bring into society the existence of a power above the human. And there isn't any other way of doing it. But as atheists are closed to this argument, as they're closed to so many other things, because the whole process of atheist belief is a closing of the mind to the rather worrying possibility that we might not be alone.
Peter Harris?
Yeah, there's a very interesting line of argument from John Gray as well, going back to what Peter Hitchens was saying about the origins of morality. John Gray refers to the new atheists as Christian heretics, partly because they put themselves outside of nature. So, for example, we have Richard Dawkins talking about the evolutionary origins of morality. And he's also aware that there are things encoded in humanity by evolution that are not nice. So, for example, Steven Pinker has suggested that the disposition to commit genocide is something that might be evolutionarily encoded in us. So therefore, there has to be some sort of arbiter or moral umpire between these different drives within humanity. Now, in a sense, when you start saying that there is such a moral arbiter, if you call it conscience, whatever, then you're actually stepping outside of evolution and the natural world. And you're actually saying that humanity is quite special in the sense that we can resist our evolutionary impulses. Now, that's quite close to the notion of what Christians say, that human beings are special, that we are the pinnacle of creation, that we are made in the image of God. So I find that very, very interesting indeed.
Ed, how do you resolve the whole thing about morality and the fact that it is difficult, I think. I think a lot of atheists would concede, despite some efforts to do it via people like Sam Harris and so on, to ground these moral beliefs, these almost... innate beliefs that there really is a right and a wrong about certain things in a universe where there's no one to really call that distinction.
Well, yeah, the entire evolutionary process, I mean, there was a time when, you know, there was a natural selection advantage to genocide and rape. I mean, where was the divine law, you know, 100,000 years ago? You know, Hitch's 98,000-year gambit challenge, God waits around with his arms folded for 98,000 years while we're, you know, raping, killing each other, committing torture, genocide, doesn't do anything, and then decides to intervene, you know, in a particularly remote and backward part of the Middle East, you know, not in China, where there's a bit of mathematics and literature going on. You know, in some strip of desert in the Middle East, which doesn't even have any oil under it. I want to make that argument that actually the development of evolutionary morality is actually a strong argument against there being, you know, an absolutist moral lawgiver, and that morality is malleable. As for our modern perception of morality, you know, we have, you're right. I think Sam Harris has dealt with this much better in his book, The Moral Landscape. You know, that we know scientifically, you know, we know what is good and bad for humans. We know what constitutes a healthy person. We know that it would not be a good idea to put cholera in our water supply. We know enough about the human nervous system to know that dousing someone in petrol and setting fire to them is going to be excruciatingly painful.
Does that provide enough to... I mean, this is another huge can of worms to open, but Peter Harris, is that enough to kind of ground a morality, just the scientific facts of what happens to the nervous system if you set it on fire?
Well, I think scientists themselves have been rather reticent about saying this. Richard Feynman, the Nobel Prize winner for physics, said that science is very descriptive of the universe, but it doesn't tell you what you ought to do. I mean, it can provide you the information that will help you make the decision as to what to do, but it doesn't actually tell you in the ultimate scenario what to do. I mean, John Lennox uses the example of a boiling kettle. Now, science can tell you why water boils in a kettle, but it doesn't tell you whether you ought to pour it over someone's head. Einstein.
Well, I think it does. We know scientifically. We can say that would be very, very painful.
Yes, I know. But
absolutely.
But some
people like pouring water over people's heads,
and would not be conducive to, you know, the flourishing of human life.
But then you're introducing a moral.
Yes,
I agree that there is
a certain, you know, philosophical gap that is jumped between.
That's the philosophical gap that Harris was criticised for.
This is that morality is an infinite spectrum of grey areas. I mean, I've got a stack of cashew nuts in my bag. It may be a moral thing to do to give Peter Harris some cashew nuts. Let's say, for the sake of argument, Justin, you are allergic to nuts. And, you know, this is a good Da Vinci Code way of killing you. And that would be, a completely immoral
thing. All I know is I'm not taking any of those cashew nuts now. But Peter Hitch, and what would you say that your brother was at any level an optimist when it came to science, as it were, giving us the answers and being able to nail down morality and give us a brighter future and so on?
Well, I think there were flashes of this bizarre belief in some of the things he wrote, but like me, I think his education in the sciences and his knowledge of them was pretty slender. But it is, again, a way that of both Marxists and atheists are always very keen on going on and on about the triumphs of science and its ability to explain everything. It's a sort of scientism and a substitute for the cosmology which religion gives you, which many people grope for. But I don't think in his hands it meant very much. I never got the impression that he had any particular grasp of any of the sciences. We weren't really made to learn them particularly well when we were at school, and we often came out with a rather rigid and ignorant view of what they were about. So no, I don't take that very seriously at all.
Well, we're going to take a quick break, and we'll be back for some final thoughts from my three guests. It's been a really interesting discussion on the world's favourite anti-theist, as I've been calling him, Christopher Hitchens. And was he right about religion? We'll be wrapping up today's programme in just a moment's time. This is Unbelievable with me, your host, Justin Brierley, through till 4 o'clock this Saturday afternoon. Hello and welcome back to Unbelievable. I'm Justin Brierley, and this is the third and final part of today's programme. I'll be here, though, afterwards, if you're listening between 4 and 5 to The Profile. As part of Faith Explored, I'll be talking to Hugh Osgood. He's a church planter and a man who's actually brought many black and white churches together over the years of his ministry. So that's between 4 and 5 this afternoon on Premier Christian Radio. Next week on the programme, well, we're still nailing down exactly what it will be, but we may be able to bring you a conversation on whether Muslims and Christians worship the same God. That's been in our news recently because of the recent dismissal of a tutor, a lecturer at Wheaton College, Illinois. And so we'll be trying to set up a show on that very soon, at least, for the programme. And of course, I want to also make you aware again of Unbelievable, the conference 2016. And so I'll be sharing a little bit more detail on that in a moment's time. The programme is brought to you in association with Premier Christianity Magazine. I'm the senior editor of that publication. We've also got a lively blog which often picks up on current affairs and issues. We had a very popular blog that went out last week on Christian TV presenter Dan Walker, the new face of BBC Breakfast, and some of the criticism of him in the press for apparently holding creationist beliefs. Well, David Robertson, who's a regular commentator on the blog and on this programme, wrote a really interesting article responding to that, and that was viewed by a lot of people. One of our biggest articles of all time, really, actually, on the Premier Christianity blog. But one that you may be interested in as well, if you're a listener to Unbelievable, is the recent one by Heather Tomlinson. And I'll read out some of that blog a little later, giving 10 reasons why Christians should give thanks for Richard Dawkins, who hasn't been very well recently. So I'll read you a little bit of what Heather had to say on the blog recently soon as well. But if you want to get yourself a free sample copy of the magazine, find out what you've been missing if you're not a subscriber. PremierChristianity.com/freesample is the place to go. Right now, let's finish up our conversation about Christopher Hitchens.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Well, it's been a really interesting discussion on Christopher Hitchens. Was he right about religion? And he was, if you like, the cream of the crop when it came to the new atheist movement. He shone very brightly within that sphere. His book, God is Not Great, How Religion Poisons Everything, was brought widely in the North American market and elsewhere besides. It's influenced people like my guest Ed Turner, who's an atheist blogger. It's been responded to by many people like Peter Harris, who's been here telling us about a little bit about some of the things he's talking about in his PhD when it comes to this issue. And Peter Hitchens has been here as well by phone to reflect on his late brother's views on faith and religion and so on. Peter, this may be a somewhat personal question, but did you ever feel like your brother had any kind of softening towards religion at any level in the latter stages of his life?
I didn't. I've come across people who do, but I didn't. And what I think you have to understand is that he always remained interested. He would argue with quite pleasantly and in a civil fashion with religiously minded people right up to the end, because that was what he was like and what he preferred to do. But I don't think beyond that there was anything to suggest any softening at all. No, and I think it would be silly of me to claim it, because it would it, it would be annoying to his memory, because he was very insistent. So if anybody catches me on my deathbed saying I've converted, then they're or anybody claiming that I have, then they're to dismiss it as a lie. He was very determined not to do that.
So indeed.
No, I don't think so.
I remember one interesting quote, though. He was involved in a documentary that was filmed in a number of debates he had with an American pastor called Doug Wilson in a documentary called Collision. At one point, I think he was asked, you know, would you like to see, in the end, all religion banished from the face of the earth for everyone to dismiss religion? And I think his answer was something along the lines of, no, I wouldn't actually. And when asked why, he said, because life's much more interesting when you've got people to disagree with. I mean, would that sort of sum up the way his ultimate view towards religion, Peter?
Oh, there was a bit more to it than that. I wish I had to hand a little recording which deals with that. I didn't come really prepared enough for this. A bit more than that, as you would find in Thomas Hardy, who was surprisingly sympathetic to religious claims, given particularly Jude the Obscure, and wasn't as dismissive of them as people thought he was. It's the problem with being, as it were, the sort of leader of a movement. Your supporters often are more militant than you and require you to be. It would seem to me that any open-minded person has to concede. I think the subtitle of his book, Religion Poisons Everything, was a mistake, and I suspect
it claimed too much in that sense.
He didn't really believe that, because of the huge, particularly cultural and poetic contribution that the Christian religion in particular has made to civilization. I think he was more open-minded than his more fanatical supporters would like him to be, but I don't think that means that he ever softened towards religion.
No, sure. It's been great having you on the programme today, Peter. Thank you very much for taking some time to be with us. Ed, do you think that Christopher Hitchens' legacy will continue to inspire new generations of atheists?
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. As he said, there was nothing new about the new atheism. It was just the most recent. None of the arguments in favour of God are new, and therefore none of the arguments against God were new. He put a new spin on it. And, you know, I've debated a few people on the show who've spat blood at this suggestion. But before I read The God Delusion, I was an agnostic. I was afraid to criticise religion. If people brought faith into the conversation, then that was it. That was argument over. But books like The God Delusion and God Is Not Great gave me the confidence to actually have the argument and not be worried about offending people. You know, we don't respect people's beliefs in any other sphere. You know, we scrutinise people's political views. You know, we do not respect the views of Holocaust deniers and anti-Semites. And I think Christopher Hitchens and the other four horsemen and their followers will continue to, inspire. Give a voice to the people, you know, the silent, silent minority, silent majority.
I don't know. Not so silent anymore. In a sense, they were perhaps riding the crest of a wave of people kind of, in a way, developing a very strident criticism of religion. Not that that hasn't existed before, but perhaps in a more public setting. Final thoughts from you as well, Peter Harris, on all of this?
Well, I think the Christopher Hitchens project doesn't really get off the ground, because I don't think he ever really addressed the criticisms of materialism, which is the worldview that founds his beliefs. I think he's a bit of a victim of his own book's title, because if you say all religion is poisonous, you're making a universal proposition, and the only thing you need to do to disprove a universal proposition is to find one exception, and there are many exceptions. I find the errors in his work a problem, particularly his chapter where he looks at science and religion and just considers their relationship as an adversarial one. If you look at the works of historians of science like John Headley Brook, you'll see actually there's a whole range of relationships between science and religion. The error where he says that Jesus does not exist, one of his own mentors in this, Bart Ehrman, whom he erroneously calls Barton Ehrman, actually says no serious New Testament scholar disbelieves in the existence of Jesus, and Bart Ehrman is himself a sceptic. But having said all of that, one thing I will say in his favour is that he's not a scientistic person. He never believed that science was the only way you can understand reality. He said when it comes to morals and values, you really ought to go towards literature. And I have a lot of sympathy for that because I teach literature. But unfortunately, some people in the list of writers that he advocates us going to were Christian writers, so I don't know how to square that one.
He squared that one off. Yes, he remains a fascinating character, and well beyond his death as well. It's been great to be able to talk about Hitch and his anti-theism today on the programme. If you've got a thought on this, then I'll be making sure to give you the ways to get in touch with the programme as well in a moment's time. I'll make sure there are links to all of my guests, Peter Hitchens, Peter Harris and Ed Turner, on the show page. If you want to find out more about today's programme, share it with others and links to my guests. That's at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. For the moment, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Peter and Ed.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Well, if you'd like to get in touch with the programme today, can I encourage you to email unbelievable@premier.org.uk. You can also get in touch via Facebook and Twitter. Leave your comments that way, at UnbelievableJB or facebook.com/UnbelievableJB to follow along on Facebook. Regular updates as well there, things that I post from the Premier Christianity blog, from other websites, news about the show and that kind of thing to keep you informed about what's going on. You can also leave comments underneath today's programme at the website itself, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. There's links there to the Unbelievable Conference 2016. Glad to be able to open the ticketing as of today. And if you want to find out more about it, you can click through and look at the various topics and speakers that we're going to be having at this year's conference. Going for a theme of evangelism this year, discover your inner evangelist. Bit of a fun graphic, actually, that we've used for the conference this year. It's of a man ripping open his jacket, Superman style, with a letter E emblazoned underneath. You don't have to be a superhero, in my view, to be an evangelist, to be an effective evangelist. And so we're going to be talking about natural evangelism. J. John, that's one of his specialities. And he's a well-known face on the UK evangelistic scene, a much-loved speaker, and is often involved in mission events and that kind of thing. He's going to be bringing decades of experience to the conference himself, and I know he's going to be a very popular speaker at the conference. Gary Habermas is bringing his education and distinguished apologetic career to the fore as well. He's going to be joining us to talk about the resurrection and various other aspects of apologetics. Jeremiah J. Johnston of the Christian Thinkers Society, who partner with us this year for the conference, will be there. Tanya Walker, Ruth Jackson, Yemi Adeshina. We're going to have a youth apologetic strand or ways to reach young people. Yemi and Ruth will both be involved in that particular strand. And there are more speakers to yet be announced. So look out for that on the page at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable2016. You can get a sense of the prices, some of the special offers. You can get the Unbelievable Conference DVD and CD that we produced last time for free if you book two or more tickets, for instance. And there's also an early bird rate too, up to the 15th of April. So all available, as I mentioned, at the website, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable2016. This was fun by Heather Tomlinson on the Premier Christianity blog in the last week. She wrote a piece on Richard Dawkins, 10 Reasons Why Christians Should Thank Him. This was in light of the fact that he had recently had a mini stroke. We heard that the Church of England tweeted a prayer for him. And it was wrongly thought, in Heather's view, by some to be sarcastic. And there was a bit of a fuss about it. But Heather says, I see plenty of private expressions of concern and genuine warmth from my friends of faith, too. Some atheists are saying we shouldn't pray for him and perhaps he wouldn't want us to. But I think they underestimate how fond we are of the old fella. Of course, we're supposed to love our enemies. And you could argue Dawkins is such. His acerbic critiques of religion have got many backs up, including mine at times. But from what I know about the guy, I really like him. And I don't think I'm the only Christian who feels this. I also think that overall he's been good for the church. Here are some reasons why Christians should be thanking Richard Dawkins. Now, I won't read all of the reasons out, but let me give a few of them at least. Firstly, Dawkins has encouraged committed Christians to think. Once upon a time, a common Christian response to questions like how can an all-powerful and all-loving God allow suffering and what about the slaughter passages was, well, you've just got to have faith. Well, that kind of theological flippancy is no more, by and large. Partly we can credit this to Dawkins because the amount of media coverage his ideas have received and the rise of militant atheism has meant that Christians have been inspired to think more about what they believe and why. Secondly, he's got everyone talking about religion again. It may be hard to remember, but before Dawkins' book, The God Delusion, religion was a dirty word and hardly anyone discussed it in the public square. Now it's back on the agenda. Some people have become atheists as a result, but many have become Christians too, such as Peter Byram, and Heather links to Peter's testimony. Thirdly, his intentions are good. Dawkins genuinely believes he's doing the right thing in battling religion. If you look at his reasoning, he cites atrocities such as 9/11 and extrapolates that religion is the cause of human misery. We don't agree with his reasoning regarding Christianity, but at least he cares about the human condition. We've just yet to persuade him that Jesus is the answer. And Heather goes on to list seven more. Perhaps you'd like to read them for yourself. Go to the blog, premierchristianity.com/blog, to read what Heather put down as the 10 reasons why Christians should give thanks for Richard Dawkins. Okay, let's go to some of your emails that have come in about last week's programme. We were talking to Luke Griffiths Williams about his journey from being a Christian to a Jewish to atheist, and he was in conversation with Messianic Jew Richard Harvey. There was a number of comments on the Facebook page when I put this up there. This one from Dwayne Howard and Doug Nicole Hawksworth, both didn't appreciate Richard's responses to Luke. Dwayne says, ironically, Richard summed up the intellectual dishonesty and sheer willful ignorance that's required to believe that mythological fairy tales like Christianity are true when he says in the 43rd minute of the podcast that at the end of the day, you have to doubt your doubts and believe your beliefs. And Doug Hawksworth says, all that I can say is unbelievable. This episode was a complete circus. What do you get when you pit an existentialist against a skeptic who has a bit of trouble articulating himself? It was simply a list of reasons, albeit weak ones in my opinion, why it cannot be true, countered by question begging. This was a conversation bound for nowhere. I'm sorry, but I think it was quite insulting when Richard basically accused Luke of being naive and ignorant, assuming, rather than asking, that he couldn't possibly have heard all the right arguments, read this as the ones he accepts, simply because he wasn't coming to the same conclusions that he did. It couldn't possibly be that Luke had actually heard and seriously considered all of those arguments and that they were just wanting in the end. I had wished that Luke would have riffled back that Richard must have misunderstood those arguments since he found them inadequate. Thank you very much. Anyway, obviously, difference of opinion on whether how Richard responded to that. I thought Richard did some interesting and good responses, actually. And the thing about at the end of the day, you have to doubt your doubts and believe your beliefs. I think there's something in that, in as much as I think we all come to a point where, you know, for any Christian who's thought through the issues, that some kind of doubts will remain. And there has to be a point at which you say, well, I'm going to make a decision now. I'm not going to remain agnostic. I'm going to decide to, yeah, in that sense, doubt my doubts and believe my beliefs. Obviously, it depends on how great your doubts are and how strong your beliefs are in that sense. But I think there's something to what Richard had to say there. I don't dismiss it as quickly as you do, Dwayne. Ben on the Facebook page says, Luke, I'm not sure if you'll see this, but I encourage you to read Lucy Pepiat's recent book, Women and Worship at Corinth. Now, this comes in relation to the discussion that he had with Richard on the issue of wearing veils and head coverings that came up in the programme. And you say that Lucy Pepiat makes a fascinating and, I think, compelling argument that Paul is, in fact, arguing against women in the Corinthian church being made to wear head coverings. She makes the case that Paul quotes some men from the Corinthian church who were trying to make women wear head coverings and then refutes their argument, ending with, if anyone is inclined to be contentious, we have no such practice, nor do the churches of God. What if the practice Paul is referring to is that of women wearing head coverings during worship? Many scholars who have written on 1 Corinthians say that this passage is one of the most perplexing in the Bible. You're in good company. Thank you very much, Ben. Here were a couple that came in on email in response to that particular programme. This was David, who said the discussion seemed to conflate the alleged deity of Jesus with his alleged messiahship, which are two very different things. Luke gave his reasons for disbelieving in Jesus' deity, but these were not examined, and it morphed quickly into a discussion of his messiahship, as if the two are the same issue. In fact, Jesus can be the messiah without being God, whatever that means, and Luke laid bare some of the incoherence in God becoming a man while remaining somehow God. Furthermore, Jewish objections to Christianity, because they reject Jesus as Messiah, are quite different from their objections to God becoming a man. A pity the programme didn't seem to explore these types of objections and the differences between them. And Jonathan Mitchell, PhD at Stephen F. Austin State University, says in the most recent episode, your atheist guest Luke at one point seemed to suggest that religious morality lagged behind what I presume to be humanistic morality. He mentioned examples like homosexual marriage, females as clergy, and I think even slavery. I'm no historian, but I was under the impression Christians were some of the most influential leaders in many social and moral issues. Martin Luther King in the civil rights movement in America, Wilberforce for the abolition of the slave trade, even the unjust treatment of women has been condemned by many Christians. I can't help but note that the gospel writers were, despite cultural pushback, honest in their recounting of the women being the first to see the empty tomb. Not a great way to fabricate a resurrection. I don't suppose Luke would consider abortion immoral, which brings me to my main point, Justin. Have you considered having a debate about when life begins in the womb? Perhaps you've hosted such a discussion already, and I do need to comb through the archives. I will do. In the meantime, perhaps Scott Klusendorf, author of The Case for Life, versus David Boonin, author of A Defense of Abortion. Christians are leading the charge against the immoral yet quite legal poisoning, dismemberment, vacuum suctioning, etc. of an entire class of individuals, each of whom deserve the same rights to live that autonomous adults afford themselves. I do not support violence against abortion doctors, as some Christians have in the past, but the call to support or at least recognise that imago Dei in all humans necessitates we open the casket and discuss such issues, despite the gruesome details. Love your show. Can't always listen in time to email, but I did this week. Thank you very much, Jonathan. Yes, we have, as you rightly guessed, had a number of shows dealing with abortion, and you can comb through the archives to find them. And yes, we've talked to some extent about the issue of when life begins. Scott Klusendorf has been a guest a couple of times in those discussions, and so I think you'll probably find them quite instructive. That's not to say we won't do another one at some point down the line. Obviously, we haven't done one since the whole Planned Parenthood thing happened out in the States. Thanks for emailing in. Maybe time for one more. Jeremy Behrman listens from South Africa and says, your unbelievable show is incredible, Justin. I was supposed to make a contribution in writing about how I lost my faith as a consequence of long-term ill health, but I was too ill for several months to even compose anything. I have had a long Jewish upbringing, but after developing ME, which has had a devastating impact on my quality of life, I found it progressively harder to believe in God. I see my atheism as a great achievement. Having to suffer so much in life, a person would normally have loved to go to heaven and enjoy eternal bliss. And ultimately, in our worldview, there is no overarching meaning to life to comfort and reassure. Atheism offers none of the psychological comforts of religion. I know Professor Dawkins is extreme, but he made some good points. Faith is not a virtue. Religion teaches us to be satisfied with not knowing. The universe does not owe us a purpose, and we shouldn't have such an unwarranted confidence in our own importance in a cosmic sense. Dawkins also contends there's often no rhyme or reason as to whether we're hit by terrible misfortune and possibly destroyed, or alternatively have a relatively carefree existence. It makes me better knowing that there is no good reason for my suffering. But I know that not all Christians share this view. Thinking that Jesus was suffering along with me and that God has a special plan for me is actually unappealing to me. I've listened to about 24 of your shows in podcast form, and you mentioned that you hope that the show will be illuminating and stimulate us to consider things. Although you come across as very erudite and also very pleasant and congenial, and in fact a terrific ambassador for Christianity, the discussions on your show have strengthened my atheist convictions considerably. Anyway, I thought I would write when I felt well enough. Your show is terrific and you're a phenomenal host. Most other audio shows or podcasts on the topic of religion are poorly produced and poorly presented. And that's Jeremy in Cape Town. Thank you, Jeremy, for getting in touch. I appreciate you taking the time to do that. I'm glad you're well enough at least to compose an email now. As you say, different people have very different responses, I suppose, emotional and intellectual responses to the problem of suffering. And I can't claim to have ever been in the position you've obviously been in and the great pain you've gone through. But I know of many Christians who would say, having been through similar circumstances to you, that having some kind of purpose to hold on to in the big frame of things was a lifeline to them. That was the only way they could make sense of suffering, and that in a sense, getting rid of that sense of an overarching purpose and narrative to life in an atheistic framework would have made the suffering meaningless. in some sense. But I appreciate that's not the way you've experienced it. Thank you for listening. Anyway, Jeremy, hope you're listening to this programme and can hear me read out your email. Just a reminder, you can get hold of the details of the new Unbelievable the Conference coming up in July the 2nd, 2016, in central London. Do check out the details at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. You can click through to the ticketing page from there. I shall be back in a moment's time with the profile. My guest today is Hugh Osgood. For the moment, let me tell you what I'm hoping to bring you at this time next week.
You're unbelievable.
Hoping to bring you a conversation on whether Christians and Muslims worship the same God. There's been some controversy over in the States after a lecturer at Wheaton College, Illinois, was dismissed for making that claim, and we'll be looking at it with a couple of guests as per usual. But for the moment, thank you for being with me on the programme that aims to get you thinking, and hopefully I'll see you at the same time next week.